listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your co-host, Alan Cardoza. With me is my co-host extraordinaire, psychologist, Dr. Melody Fox.
And every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific Standard Time, or I guess we're in daylight savings time now, we will bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain you while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future.
And Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, and dealing with addictions.
With our many years of experience, both Alan and I, with families in crisis, we've both been fortunate enough to meet and work with some of the top professionals who are striving to make this world a better place for all of us.
And we will bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family.
And we're thrilled to have as our guest today one such talented professional, David Sachs, MD. Now, Dr. Sachs serves as the CEO of Promises Treatment Centers and Elements Behavioral Health and is a board-certified addiction psychiatrist and addictionologist.
And Dr. Sachs' experience includes a research career in psychopharmacology and biological rhythms, as well as serving as a senior scientist at the National Institute of Mental Health.
Now, Dr. Sachs has designed and managed clinical care delivery systems, including psychiatric hospitals and behavioral health organizations in both rural and urban mental health and substance abuse treatment programs.
And Dr. Sachs previously served as the medical director and senior vice president of Aspen Education Group, a company specializing in the treatment of at-risk youth and their families.
And Dr. Sachs, I'd like to welcome you to Answers for the Family. How are you doing today?
Terrific. Thank you, Melody and Alan, for having me.
Well, we're just thrilled that you're here today. And I know you have such a long history of working with people using drugs, both adults and teens. And I was just wondering, why do you think teens start using drugs, in your opinion?
Well, there are a lot of reasons why teens experiment with drugs. I think part of it is curiosity. Kids want to do what the cool kids are doing. So if they know that people are experimenting with pot and getting high, they're going to want to try it. Or if their friends are drinking, they're going to want to have a beer. And so at the beginning, a lot of it is curiosity. But most kids stop there. That is, experimentation does not lead to chronic or habitual substance use in most kids.
And why are some children more at risk than others?
Well, there are a lot of factors that seem to play a role. Certainly, family history and genetics is part of it. We know that the children of alcoholics are significantly more likely to use and become dependent on alcohol than other kids. In fact, one half of all of the children of alcoholics become alcoholics. So this is a huge family and genetic risk factor. But the real story, I think, has to do with other emotional problems. That when you look at teenagers who become regular users of drugs or alcohol, that many of them, in fact, the majority, have had other emotional problems before they ever started to use drugs.
Do you think they're self-medicating then, for the most part, if they're having other problems prior to?
Well, I think that you know, the whole idea of self-medication is that the people are taking a drug to feel better from an emotional symptom they're already having. So the kid who's anxious might drink alcohol to calm their anxiety, or the kid that doesn't have confidence may take amphetamines to pump up their confidence. And I think that there is some of that, particularly with kids who have low self-esteem and are socially isolated. They may use drugs to try to manage down those feelings. Mm-hmm. And so we tend to think of that as self-medication, and that becomes a reason for why they're doing it. The reality is that some of them have serious psychiatric problems. You know, were diagnosed with attention deficit disorder early on, and so they had trouble relating to their peers. And so what we're seeing is a personality structure and a world experience that makes them feel different than other people, makes them feel isolated, and they turn to drugs in part to get a social community, that they have a group of people now who they're getting high with, and that defines their peer group.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dr. Sachs, we just had a guest on. We talked about some of the things going on in Haiti and such, and what some of the kids are doing down there. And one of the things that made me think of, and setting aside the person with the serious psychological problem, what can we do as parents to where our kids aren't just drawn towards it? Because when you mention, you know, if they're having low self-esteem, well, you know, you think about it, and here we are, we're in Southern California, and, I mean, we really shouldn't be in a position to where our kids have low self-esteem when you take into consideration everything else that's going on around the world. What are some of the things that we can do to make sure that they recognize just how great they have it?
Well, I think part of what we sometimes mistake is material success, that is, having a level of affluence and financial security, and confusing that with emotional success and emotional security. You know, most American families are under tremendous pressure emotionally because you have both parents working, and where the amount of time that's left over to nurture and support the children in that family has been significantly reduced compared to previous generations. And so, you know, part of what I think parents have to do in this day and age is to consciously make time for the family to be together and to create an opportunity for communication and dialogue, because the time itself has been so squeezed and so compressed. So, you know, when we talk about, well, how do you prevent drug abuse? Well, you could say, well, you know, don't allow any drugs in the house. Or you could say, you should all sit down and have dinner together and talk about what you're doing and share your opinions and thoughts about what's going on in your respective worlds. Mm-hmm. And I think that sharing and that mutual awareness of what your kid is doing, how they're spending their time, what things are important to them, is a big part of how we can protect against drug abuse.
Well, it also shares the family value system on what the family deems important or not important, and where they feel about drug use or abuse or other aspects. And if you have that open communication, I think that builds a lot of that foundation of you know, virtue and values and characteristics for a child.
Absolutely, Melody. But the point I'm going to make is that many times a family knows that their kid is in trouble. Mm-hmm. The kid's acting strange. He's oppositional. He's angry. He's sulking. He's depressed. He's skipping school. He's getting bad grades. And then the family does everything except talk about the possibility that drugs may be involved. It's as though they're afraid that if they ask their kid if they're getting high, that they're going to put that idea in their head when they never had it before, you know. And yet the truth is that a very substantial proportion of our adolescents have experimented. They've experimented with marijuana. They've experimented with alcohol. And that we have to be, you know, willing to have this conversation with our kids.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would say, I completely agree. I think it also may have to do with the fact of the child's reaction, that the parents are so concerned with their child's reaction, because many times the kids are going to say, what are you accusing me of? And all of a sudden, the parent doesn't want that conflict, so they somehow tiptoe around it. Would you agree?
And, you know, I think that I would agree, and I also think that, you know, we're missing a big part of the problem, which is that many of our parents are drug users. It is, they drink excessively. You know, we've certainly seen that many parents rationalize excessive drinking behavior, saying that they're entitled to party on the weekends, but in fact they're heavy binge drinkers. We live in California, where marijuana, for all intents and purposes, has become legal. And so we have a larger adult population now that feels that it's okay to smoke marijuana. There's no stigma attached to it. Mm-hmm. And so they're not in a particularly good position to counsel their kids on their behavior.
Saying, I was just thinking about not only marijuana but also alcohol. People open up a bottle of wine at night and have it over dinner or cook over it. It's all the rage to cook with it. So they're surrounded by the alcohol use as well as tobacco. And I was curious, what drugs do you think are the greatest risk today?
Well, I think that in terms of lives lost, there's no question that we have more deaths due to tobacco and alcohol than any other drugs. But if you look at what has changed, and I think that what's changed is significant, is that there are two things that have changed. One is the rise of prescription opiate abuse, that over the last 25 to 30 years, there's been a steady increase in people using prescription narcotic drugs, and the age at which they're using those drugs has gotten younger and younger. And so that we're in the midst of an epidemic of prescription narcotic abuse in the United States that starts as young as middle school.
Now, you mentioned opiates. Why do you think that the use of opiates have changed recently?
Well, they've become much more available. You know, I think that if you talk to drug abusers, you know, heroin was always a good high, but there are a lot of barriers to using heroin. First of all, it's illegal. Second of all, you have to shoot it up to really get high, although now people are smoking it. So that, you know, there are many people who would, and it's known that it's very addicting and that you can overdose. So it's known that it's not very safe. So in the normal course of affairs, most rational people would say, as good as that drug may feel, I'm not going to bother with it. What happened is that as prescriptions for pain medicines became more available in the United States because the medical community made a conscious decision to try to treat pain better, many more prescriptions for Vicodin, OxyContin, oral morphine, Dilaudid, wound up in people's medicine cabinets. And that unlike heroin, which is perceived as unsafe and that you have to inject it and it's illegal, these medicines are viewed by the public. It turns out it's not true, but it's viewed by the public that they're safer because doctor prescribed them. You don't have to worry about impurities because they're in your mother's medicine cabinet. Even though it's illegal to obtain them in excess quantities or without a prescription, they've become much more easy to obtain through the gray market, so that the availability of an opiate that appears safer, that is prescribed by doctors, that is available at pharmacies, has made people much more willing to experiment with that class of drugs.
Well, how do you think kids are getting the prescription drugs so easily, because they're prescribed to the parents for the most part? What do you think is going on there?
Well, I think that what happens is that most parents use about two or three of those pills, and then they say, gee, I may need this again if my back goes out or if my knee starts to hurt. I'm going to save them for a rainy day. And so they take that prescription narcotic that they don't give much thought to, stick it in their cabinet. And the government studies show very clearly that most teenagers get their first exposure to prescription narcotics either from their parents' medicine chest or their best friend's parents' medicine chest. That they're not buying their first taste of this drug on the street. They're getting it at home.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think prescription drugs are of such great concern, too, other than the easy access for the kids?
Well, they're very powerfully addicting. That prescription opiates are just as addicting as heroin and morphine. So you have a drug that's very powerfully addicting. And then the other problem with these drugs is that they're also very easy to overdose on, so that deaths due to ingestion of opiates keeps going up. And if you look at people who die in overdoses, almost the entire increase in overdose deaths is related to prescription opiates. What happens is teenagers believe that because these drugs are prescribed, that they're somehow safer. And so they believe that they can take those drugs and drink and smoke pot and take other pills with them, and it's okay because they're a prescription drug. Mm-hmm. And the risk of overdose due to respiratory failure is very real and very grave.
Well, and you hear that in the news a lot of times. And I'm just curious why, well, the opiates. I was just wondering if you could kind of, in layman's terms for us people that aren't quite familiar with it, how is that addiction to the opiates so strong? And is it more so than alcohol or marijuana or tobacco?
Well, on a numerical basis, there are more alcoholics than any other dependency. So, you know, it's sort of apples and oranges because the numbers are so staggering in favor of alcohol. But part of that is that alcohol is legal. So it's relatively easy to get access to alcohol, and it carries with it much less social stigma. So teenagers see their parents drinking, and they think, well, what's the big deal? If they can drink, why can't I drink? So having a drug be legal clearly makes it more abusable. I think that the concern about opiates is that the way in which they affect the brain is different. They have a very specific affinity for the brain's own reward system and pain control system. And that part of what happens is that people who have anxiety or depression experience a sense of peace and tranquility on opiates that they don't feel in their everyday life. And once they feel that sense of peace, they can't get enough of it. And so, especially in young teens who are anxious or depressed or upset or hyper, the opiates are a very attractive class of drugs.
Well, I was just wondering, you know, you're saying attractive class of drugs. There's not much of a hangover from that than they would get from alcohol. Is that also something that drives them towards that?
Well, in general, the physical side effects from the drug itself are less than they are with alcohol. But as soon as someone becomes dependent on them, then the withdrawal is very intense. So someone who starts to use OxyContin regularly is going to experience significant withdrawal symptoms within 24 hours of stopping its use. And that, again, becomes a very powerful motivator to keep using.
Wow.
Now, for us as parents, and that's what the majority of our listeners out there are parents and probably parents of teens, what are some of the things that you recommend that we do to keep our kids away from these things or to be able to identify it when it is happening?
Well, we talked about having frank conversations with the kids, acknowledging that drugs and alcohol are out there, what your expectations are around the use, why they're dangerous. You know, I think that's the starting off point. Mm-hmm. I think that if there's a change in behavior that is unexplained, in other words, you have a kid who exhibits a marked change in their behavior, their grades go from good to failing, they become angry and oppositional, they withdraw to their room, they have a change in their friends, they're not abiding house rules. I think any of those things should trigger the consideration that drugs may be involved. You know, and I know that there are parents in our audience who are thinking, well, isn't that just normal adolescent behavior? And the answer, in some kids, it's normal adolescent behavior, but in other kids, it's the beginning of a drug crisis where they're going to escalate their drug use and where their behavior is going to deteriorate as a result of it. And in those, and for parents who are facing this, I strongly recommend that you drug test your kids. Because at least you'll know what you're up against. Rather than living in a fantasy about what they are or they aren't doing, you can know. And then you can say, well, you know, you're very concerned. The evidence is that you're using drugs, and it's changing your behavior. We need to talk about this.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you recommend that they lock their drug cabinets up and keep everything separate?
Right. Well, the promise is we've become very concerned about the fact that kids are getting their exposure to prescription narcotics and sedatives at home. And so we started a campaign called Lock the Cabinets. And what we're really proposing is you have to go one of two directions. If you're going to keep pain medications in the house, and indeed there are many people who need these medicines, then you should lock the cabinets. You should make it clear that you know how many pills you have and you're tracking how much pain medicine is in the house. And so you create a deterrent for the kid experimenting, your child experimenting with your pain medicine. I think that what I really would hope to see is also that people who are given a prescription for Vicodin or oxycodone or Percocet, that when they finish their treatment, that they throw away what's left. That these are not drugs that you want to save for a rainy day. They're drugs you want to destroy, you know, sort of run, don't walk to the nearest place to destroy them, you know, because having them in the house is a liability.
Well, and I agree, as is having a stock of alcohol as well. I was thinking about that, and for those that may be able to remember when they were a teenager, is if the parents kept a bottle of vodka around the house, because it was clear, you could take a little bit out and you could put water back in, and you actually thought you could get away with it, which only works once.
I'm not going to ask how you know that, Alan.
Oh, I tried it. Believe me. But we do have a question coming in from one of our listeners, and I think it plays right into what we're talking about. It says, for almost 2 years, our 17-year-old son has been in and out of treatment for substance abuse, parentheses, primarily alcohol. My husband and I are also in counseling to understand how to deal with our son in a way that will support his treatment. Honestly, we're not seeing a dramatic change as he keeps falling off the wagon, and we feel it has a great deal to do with his peers and his friends that we cannot get out of his life. He will turn 18 in 7 months, and we are literally frightened out of our mind about what will happen to him once he turns of legal age. I am very curious to get your opinion on what our next steps should be.
Well, first of all, I would want to applaud your listener for taking the first steps of getting their child into treatment and for going to counseling for themselves to get help, because 90% of the people with a drug and alcohol problem never seek help, and their families don't seek help. So I think that they've already demonstrated a tremendous commitment to the process of trying to help their son get better. You know, the reality is that alcohol is powerfully addicting, and that, you know, you asked me earlier, why do people use? But social reinforcement, that the instant peer group that you get when you use a drug with people, is a big part of what maintains an addiction once it's in place. You know, I think that they have to look at what treatments they've tried and whether there are other treatments that might make more sense. There are a number of programs that specialize in adolescents or young adults that are long-term residential programs that focus on building social skills, filling educational gaps, working on a sense of responsibility and self-esteem that can make a difference in a person who has failed in regular residential treatment. At Promises, we see young adults, we don't see adolescents, and our minimum treatment period for those young adults is 90 days because we don't find that treating them for less than that even begins to stabilize their problem. But there are other programs for adolescents. There's one in Utah called Turnabout Ranch that was part of Aspen, where the person stays there for 6 months and they're actually working on a ranch while they're getting education, completing their schooling, and where, you know, the focus is really on personal responsibility and accountability, which is really not necessarily emphasized in an acute treatment program where you're doing a lot of education around what drug addiction is and you're trying to treat assorted associated mental problems.
Well, and I think this question also brings up that area of those 17-year-olds that are getting close to turning 18. Now with Promises, you work with young adults. How do you recommend they deal with a situation? And we get that from parents that will call us and they'll say, you know, my child's run away and can you find them? And I'll say, yes, that's fine, we can find them. But once we do that, what's your plan? And at times they'll say, well, you know, they're 3 months from 18, so we really don't have a plan. We just want to get up to that point. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can share with them some of the things that can be done when that child is nearing 18 in hopes that they can still save their child.
Right. Well, a lot of times the younger, the late adolescent with a drug problem has become an expert in manipulating their family and in dealing with how to get what they want from mom and dad. And so part of the challenge is creating distance and being willing to tolerate consequences on behalf of your kid. You know, the last thing that a mother wants to hear, and maybe a father to a lesser extent, is that their kid is sleeping on the street or is unsafe. And so they would rather see a slow death due to alcohol or drug use than run the risk that something terrible will happen to their kid if they say, you can't live here if you're using drugs. But the truth is that for most families, once the kid becomes an adult, once the child reaches majority, you have to be prepared to set limits. And you have to say, if you're living in our house, you have to agree to regular drug testing. You have to go to meetings. If they're not going to 12-step meetings like AA or NA, you have to go to meetings. You have to participate in psychotherapy, and you have to either be working or going to school. For most kids who are in the position of your caller's son, that's not going to happen. And so they have to be prepared to say what exactly they're going to do if that child doesn't follow those directions. Are they prepared to throw them out of the house? Mm-hmm. And if they throw them out of the house, what are they going to do when they get that call at midnight? Mom, I'm on a street corner. I have no money. I haven't eaten in 2 days. And how they're going to manage that. And sometimes those are things that can work out in psychotherapy with their counselor. Sometimes they'll hire an interventionist to help educate the family about how to structure this intervention so when the curtain comes down, they know exactly what's going to happen.
Well, and I think a lot of parents are so afraid of alienating their child forever, and they do get that call, and they just give in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that undermines anything and everything.
Well, I think that their idea is that somehow their child is safe if they're at home. But the truth is that they're going to overdose whether they're at home or they're not at home. And by tolerating and allowing and supporting continuing drug use, they're increasing the risk that their child's going to die of their illness.
Right.
And so we have to take the view that it may feel like it's safer if they're at home, but that's just not the case.
Yeah, that is. It's a misconception there, but you really need to stand up and be parents and be willing to take the consequences and be willing to take care of yourself so your child can learn to take care of them. And Dr. Sachs, we're going to have to take a quick break right now, and we'll be right back. We're talking to Dr. David Sachs, and we're talking about his program, Lock the Cabinet, trying to get that message out there, and drug and alcohol abuse of our teens. And we'll be right back to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 25 years ago, to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. All right, we're back. We are talking with David Sachs, MD, and we are talking about some of the things that his program does. That's Promises Treatment Center. And
Elements Behavioral Health.
And Elements Behavioral Health. And I think you were going to talk a little bit about genetics.
Well, I did have a question for Dr. Sachs, and we're talking about drug use of, you know, alcohol, drugs, opiates, marijuana. How much of our genetic makeup adds to the risk of drug or alcohol abuse, in your opinion?
Well, it's been extensively studied in alcohol, and there are lots of different ways to look at it, but in general, it seems as though somewhere around 40 to 50% of the risk to becoming an alcoholic is related to genetics, meaning that if you look at identical twins that are raised together or apart, the likelihood that if one is an alcoholic, that the second one will be an alcoholic is about the same whether they're raised together or apart, and that it basically reflects the incidence of alcohol in their family. So although there have been many studies, population studies and adoption studies and twin studies, that it appears that somewhere between a third and a half of the risk for alcoholism and in the studies that exist for other drugs as well, appears to be genetic.
And are you saying that it doesn't really matter if there was alcohol in the family? So if there were twins and one was raised in a family that had no alcohol in their family at all, but yet their biological parent was an alcoholic, and the other one was raised in a family that drank occasionally, that would have no difference in them?
That's correct. So wow. That's the part that we see as genetic. In other words, that if the idea being that if it were genetic, then whether the twins were raised together or in very different families, the proportion of risk would be the same. And that seems to be the case. But, you know, I think that people get very focused on genetics. They say, well, how much of this is genetics? And there's no question that if you're a recovering alcoholic, you should be working very hard to raise your kids in a safe environment, to be supportive, to be empathic to them, because those things will reduce their risk, even though they have your genes. In other words, there are protective factors. And the way I look at it is that even if 40% or so is genetic, then 60% is not. That is, that there's a lot of things that increase someone's risk to having a drug or alcohol problem that is not about genes. Mm-hmm. And we know what some of those things are. You know, we know that early trauma, you know, is a big factor, and that could be the loss of, or separation from a parent. That could be physical or sexual abuse. It could be, you know, a prenatal insult, you know, injury by alcohol prenatally. But there are a lot of factors that we know increase risk, including another psychiatric disorder, which may have its own genetic risk.
Wow. And so just because there's a genetic link or history in the family, someone being an alcoholic, they may have a predisposition for it, doesn't mean it'll necessarily pan out and they'll use alcohol or drugs.
That's correct. I mean, and I meet people all the time who come in with their parents who say, you know, my dad's an alcoholic and we need to get him into treatment. And I ask, you know, what about you? You know, I'll say, well, you know, you're the male son of a male alcoholic, which we know is a very high risk group. And they'll say, well, actually, I never drank. I've never had a drink. I'm 45 years old. I've never had a drink. And I think the point I'm making is that even in someone with a significant genetic risk, there is a behavioral component where if you make a decision not to expose yourself to the drug, you're not going to become addicted to it.
So you could make that choice, a conscious choice, not to go down that road if you're aware of it.
Right, right. The problem that you have is that some of these drugs are very ubiquitous. They're embedded in our society. People socialize over alcohol. They celebrate with alcohol. They relax with alcohol. They conduct business over alcohol. So that drugs, particularly the legal ones, are much harder to avoid than other drugs.
Mm-hmm. Now, and what about the genetics as it relates to addiction in itself? So, for instance, if you have somebody that, you know, their father was an alcoholic and they try alcohol, they start to have some problems with it, they back off. Is there a risk that the next thing may be cigarettes, it may be food, it may be something else that is just part of that addictive personality?
Well, that's a terrific question, and the data seems to suggest that there is. You know, there's a body of research that says that what may be inherited in some drug-prone individuals is not a propensity toward a specific drug, but rather an impulsivity disorder, a kind of being desperately driven with no brakes, and that this impulsivity, this need to take risk and put yourself in dangerous situation, is what leaves them susceptible to alcohol and drug dependency, but also to compulsive gambling and spending and compulsive sexual behavior. So there is a group, and again, it's hard to separate who that subgroup is, that seem to have this predisposition toward addiction because of this impulsivity. The other evidence that we have for that is that if you look at people who have ever been alcoholic, they have 8 times the risk of the general population of becoming drug dependent. So that people who've ever had an alcohol problem are phenomenally more likely to have a drug problem later in their lives. And the same is true for drug addiction. The people who become dependent on drugs other than alcohol have another 8 times risk of becoming dependent on alcohol. So that this risk doesn't seem to be specific to a particular drug, but rather to addiction in general.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you deal with that from an aftercare standpoint? I mean, obviously, where you're working with, you know, with a lot of people in the programs, if you have those types of issues where somebody, you've dealt with them from, let's say, an alcohol or a drug point to where they don't now have sex or, you know, food or something like that once they have now gone back to society?
Well, you know, I think that people have preferences. It isn't that an individual won't necessarily prefer to get high one way versus another. But I think you have to start with education and promises, for instance, in our other program in Tennessee, the Ranch at Piney River, they're abstinent-oriented programs. So we're basically saying the fact that you became addicted to alcohol or to marijuana or to OxyContin means that you can't abuse any drugs. We don't believe that the person who comes in as a heroin addict should be going out thinking that they can become a social drinker, because in our experience, it just doesn't work out. They'll become an alcoholic or it'll lead to a relapse on their heroin. So our belief is that the safest and most consistent way to stay healthy after you've had an addiction is to be abstinent from all drugs. Now, it isn't possible to do the same thing with food and sex. Most people, to live, they're going to have to eat, and most people, if they're going to have a normal, healthy life, are going to have sexual relationships. And so part of what we're trying to do is to help them differentiate between what is healthy and what isn't in their own lives, and help them to see how those behaviors can look a lot like addiction, and what the difference is between normal eating and eating where it's really carbohydrate craving and a kind of sugar addiction.
And how do you tell what is a normal rate? You're talking about food, but you're also talking about sexual addiction as well. How can you tell what's normal?
Well, I don't think I didn't use the word normal, Melody, you did. But
right.
But I would say that Michael wouldn't be to say what's normal, but I would say is what is healthy for them.
Okay.
So part of it is that when people are craving something, that's really not healthy. So the person who is preoccupied with obtaining sex the way they did a drug, with multiple partners, in clandestine relationships, looking for ways to gratify that, and where they feel a sense of loss and withdrawal when they're not actively, you know, seeking out a partner or having sex, that person's behavior is very much like any other addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So when they continue that behavior in the face of obvious risks, so they're having unprotected sex, or their wife is going to leave them, or they're going to develop HIV or venereal diseases, you know, those kinds of things would say this behavior is continuing even though it's really bad for me. It's not a healthy part of my normal life. And that healthy sex for most people occurs in the course of a relationship, that they're looking for sex to extend their feelings of intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
And so most people can make that distinction for themselves.
And I was just curious because, you know, we're talking about addictions and parents having difficulty confronting their children regarding drugs, but I imagine a parent trying to talk about sex to their 16-year-old girl that's running around with different guys every week and hooking up, as they say. I mean, how difficult would that be for a parent?
Well, I think it's a very difficult issue because most parents are hoping that what they fear is happening isn't really happening. So they're not fully cognizant, and there's no drug test they can give for sex. They're basically, you know, trying to maintain curfews and trying to maintain cooperation with house rules. It's not as easy. But I think that again, this comes back to that in young women, promiscuity is often part of bigger psychological issues. Low self-esteem, a history of child abuse, you know, depression, so that, you know, the parent who's concerned needs to be looking at, does my child have other problems,
mm-hmm.
and how do I treat the whole child? The sex is really a symptom of this child's problems, and those problems go well beyond just the sexual activity itself.
Right, exactly. And Alan's nodding his head over there as well.
I'm certainly agreeing that was exactly what I was thinking, is that I think in many cases what we're running into is it's more, with a 16-year-old, it's more a result of low self-esteem and trying to be accepted than at that stage than it is really an addiction.
Mm-hmm. But I'm sure it could grow into one at some point.
Right. That would make sense.
And even in adult women, you know, the sexual addiction behaviors seem to be different in women than in men. You know, with men, it's about arousal and stimulation and imagery. With women, it's about attention, courtship. They want to see that someone is interested in them physically. It's about wanting to feel important. And so I think that the same sorts of behaviors seem to have different behavioral and psychological correlates in men and women.
Well, I was just curious, too, because with Elements Behavioral Health, you oversee Promises, the Ranch, and Sexual Recovery Institute, SRI, correct?
Yes.
And when people go through the programs, regardless of their age, how do you reconnect them in society, as Alan was mentioning earlier, back into their normal world with all the vices available to them? And how do you transition for that continuity of care with other professionals, family members, support, et cetera?
Well, we start with the connecting right at the beginning. We don't treat our residential treatment programs, for instance, at the ranch or at Promises as citadels where they should be free from the outside world. It's quite the contrary. We're looking to engage the family and to educate them and bring them into the treatment starting at day one. And so at Promises, we have family therapists that work with each of our clients and their families that's separate from their individual therapists so that we can promote the family work right from the beginning when they're with us. And then we have an ongoing family support group for our alumni that meets every week that's facilitated by a psychologist and a drug and alcohol counselor to really keep the families working on the changes that they've started while they're in our program. Mm-hmm. But the truth is most families, when they leave, need more support than that. And so a big part of our discharge planning is to say, what does this patient and their family need, and who needs to be involved? And so it isn't unusual for someone who is coming out of one of our programs to need to be in individual therapy, but also to need to have family therapy for the parents or marital therapy for the couple, or a plan for, you know, life skills coaching for the child, so that our view is that each family and each client's system is different, and that what we need to do is to customize those resources to that particular individual.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, and that, I think, ties right in with the fact that, I mean, a lot of our listeners are psychiatrists, are psychologists, and so what I hear you saying is that you're really going to work with them. If you have somebody that comes out to the program, you know, you're going to work with them as well, so that when this person goes back home, they sort of understand the structure and it's sort of passed on to them from an aftercare standpoint.
That's absolutely correct. That we don't believe that we're going to be successful in what we do in the first 30 to 90 days of treatment if we're not connecting them with a therapist who's knowledgeable in these areas once they leave, and where they continue to work on their psychological issues that put them at risk in the first place. I mean, if you look at people who come out of a program and they're still depressed, let's say they do 30 days of residential treatment, and at the end of those 30 days, they say to their therapist, you know, I'm still depressed, I'm not sleeping, I don't feel good, that individual is going to have three times the risk of relapsing over the next 6 months as someone who comes out of a program who doesn't say they're depressed. So we know that people are at different levels of risk when they leave, and the important thing is to arrange for ongoing treatment that addresses those risk factors, whether it's depression or marital problems or insomnia or anxiety, that we have to have a plan so that they're working with therapists and clinicians who can help them with that problem.
And I was just curious, too. I want to make sure we get this in. What are some of the websites that maybe our listeners can link into to gather more information about you and your programs that you have?
Well, I think that about the specific programs, I would recommend that people go to the Promises main website, which is promises.com. And for the ranch at Piney River, they can go to recoveryranch.com. And so I think those are probably two good places to start. We have a lot of different pages and tabs that will take you to information on almost any drug use or what we call co-occurring problem that might be at issue. Also, there's useful information about how to get your loved one into treatment. What is an intervention? You know, what isn't an intervention? How do you go through detox? What are the challenges when someone goes through detox? So we have a lot of information on drug and alcohol and co-occurring problems on both of those sites. And then we have another website, Addiction Treatment Magazine, that talks about issues of treatment and what can be done about it. So I think those are good places to start.
Oh, that's great. I just want to make sure we got that in there before we run out of time. We still have a few more minutes, though.
Well, thank you so much.
Right. And actually, we have another comment that has come in through the email, and I want to share with the listeners, we really appreciate these emails. Mm-hmm. I thank you very much when you send them in, and I will always do everything we can to get them in and to get these questions answered. This one comes from someone who says, first, let me state that I have been a child psychologist for 15 years. It says, because of the overwhelming number of cases that are coming in to me that are directly associated with drug and alcohol abuse by 13 to 17-year-olds, I have created a partnership with two associates to counsel the parents. So far, it is working beautifully. I have been reading your website since we received Alan's press release and wanted to applaud you for your group's excellent work. It shows that you see the value of working with the whole family.
And I think that's directed towards our guest, too, in the program that he has and working with the family.
Oh, it is directed directly to him. It went to his website. Absolutely. This is certainly directed towards you.
I want to thank your listener for their kind comments. I think that there was a time, I mean, what happens at the beginning of drug and alcohol treatment is that the family knows that their relative is in trouble, and they're afraid that something terrible is going to happen, or something terrible has already happened. So there may have been an overdose or a suicide attempt, or the person's driven their car into a tree, or they've been arrested trying to distribute or acquire drugs. So it's the beginning of treatment. Something terrible has either happened, or the family and friends are afraid that something terrible is about to happen. And, you know, again, the terrible that's about to happen might be that their child is going to run away, that they're going to overdose, that they'll be attacked on the street. You know, we know that kids that are involved with drug or alcohol are at much greater risk to be assaulted or raped. So again, you know, the fear is what's driving people into treatment. And usually at that stage, families are very focused on getting their relative into treatment. Mm-hmm. But, you know, something changes once that individual starts treatment. And part of what happens is that, you know, families have often been through hell and high water with the addict before they get to treatment. Their child may have been stealing money from them. They've been flaunting curfews. They've been verbally abusive. They've been, you know, stealing and lying. And so at the moment that the parents or the spouses see that their relative is safe, they become besieged by all their anger and resentment about the addiction. And so, you know, part of treatment is really helping them to calm down and to realize that these resentments and these feelings were accumulated over a long period of time, and that people who are addicted are impulsive and show poor judgment and would not necessarily view their own behaviors in a positive light once they stop using. And so the family has to really be reeducated about how much of that behavior was the addiction as opposed to malicious intent on the part of their loved one.
And I think also developmentally, a lot of teens are naturally rebellious at times. And how much is it in the normal phase and how much of it is not, and how much would a parent accept of that rebellious behavior?
Right. But it is part of the reason why, you know, we emphasize that when people leave, it's important for them to be connected to support groups like 12-step recovery groups, because part of what 12-step programs try to do is to address the moral and spiritual catastrophe that occurs in the wake of an addiction. Mm-hmm. By helping that individual to face the things that they've done, to try to make amends for them, and to try to develop the ability to be much more caring and involved in the world that they live in.
Now, Dr. Sachs, I want to tell you that, I mean, I'm familiar with Promises and very much impressed with the things that you've been doing there. I'm not as familiar with your program in Tennessee. Can you tell us just a little bit? We've got about a minute and a half, and just tell us a little bit about that program and how it differs from Promises.
Sure. Well, the program in Tennessee is called the Ranch at Piney River. It's located on within a 2,000-acre cattle ranch. It's on the sprawling rolling hills about 45 miles outside of Nashville, so it's easy to get to through the Nashville airport. The emphasis, because we have this great space and we have the river running through the property and we have horses on the property, is to create a more of an experiential treatment where we use the nature and the environment that we're in there to create therapeutic experiences that help the individuals. So we have a lot of equine-assisted therapy. We have ropes courses. We have sweat lodges. So that we have canoe trips. We try to use the environment that we're in to create challenges and opportunities for people to evaluate their feelings, to learn to relate to other people differently. So I think that's part of the difference. And it's a longer program than Promises Malibu. The minimum length of stay is about 60 days in Tennessee, although we will admit people for 30 days. Really, we're encouraging people to stay at least 60 days. Mm-hmm. And because they're with us longer, we have a chance to complete much of the therapy that while they're still with us. Mm-hmm. There is a focus on early trauma there. So we do a lot of work with individuals about their family of origins and the issues that they may have experienced growing up in their families, neglect, abuse. And so we try to focus on those things to a much greater extent there. We have several different programs at the ranch. We have a program for sexual recovery. We have an eating disorders program. And all of the treatment at the ranch is gender separate, meaning that the women and the men are treated separately. So those are some of the differences.
Okay, well, Dr. Sachs, we do have to wrap up. We're running out of time. I so want to thank you for joining us today on Answers for the Family. Don't forget, you can go to promises.com or recoveryranch.com and get more information. And just a quick review, remember, parents, don't be afraid to drug test. Don't be afraid to have those candid conversations with your teens and your children. And make it a habit, as Dr. Sachs is trying to get the word out, lock your cabinet. Lock the cabinet. So do that. Keep your medication safe, and in turn, keep your kids safe. And thanks a bunch. On behalf of Alan Cardoza and myself, Dr. Melody Fox, we will talk to you next week on Answers for the Family. Have a great week.
All right. Bye now.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.